Did you ever have a verse of scripture or a story out of scripture that just kept coming back over and over and over again? You just couldn't get it out of your head? I think most of us could say yes to that. I'm just going to warn you, if that happens to you, don't mention to pastor that it's going on, or you might be asked to be up here. Some of you are laughing, but you know I'm right. So, way back when, before the coronavirus was a pandemic and it was just a problem starting up, I was listening to a sermon online that was addressing how we should react in these times, what our reaction should be, and there was just a little mention in there of Peter coming out of Matthew in the story of when Jesus walked on water. And just a little mention about Peter being distracted. And that kind of started this journey that I went on. And I'll be honest with you, up to about 2 weeks ago, I thought I knew exactly where this message was going to go. I had it laid out. I had done some research. I thought I knew where it was going. And as I found out, that was not the direction that we were supposed to go with this. So if you don't mind, we're just going to go on a little journey through this section. We're going to be reading Matthew chapter 14, verses 22 through 33. Immediately he made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, while he dismissed the crowd. And after he had dismissed the crowd, he went up onto the mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone. But the boat, by this time, was a long way from the land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them. And in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them, walking on the sea. But when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified and said, "It is a ghost." And they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid." And Peter answered him, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." And he said, "Come." So Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water. And when he came to Jesus, but when he saw the wind, he was afraid and began to sink. He cried out, "Lord, save me." Jesus immediately reached out his hand and took hold of him, saying to him, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased, and those in the boat worshiped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." So, as I told you, as of about 3 weeks ago, I'm going to give you the sermon in a very brief form that I would have given then. Because every sermon that I've read and watched seems to hit the same points. So, how many of you have seen the movie Onward? If you're out there in video land, raise your hand, because I can see you too. Have you guys seen the movie Onward? A few of you? Okay. Don't worry, for those of you that haven't, I have another example after this that will be much more of your era. Or my era, you might say. So in the movie Onward, there's two teenage brothers, okay? And it's Ian and Barley, Lightfoot, and they have a task, a journey to go on. And as part of this quest that they're on, they have to cross a bottomless pit, okay? And the only way to cross it is Ian has to cast a spell to create an invisible bridge. Okay, now, it's an invisible bridge, so you can't see it. So the part of the spell and the moral of it is you have to believe with every single step that the bridge is there. Lack of belief, no bridge. Okay? Now, for those of you that have not watched Onward, how many of you have seen Raiders of the Lost Ark, The Last Crusade? There you go. That's more like it. So in that, you may remember, Indiana Jones has a very similar task. There is a giant canyon and there is an invisible bridge, and he has to have faith that there is a bridge there that will take him across the void. And he has to step out on faith. That is the message that I've heard most preached out of this story, is that Peter steps out on the bridge, he loses his faith, his focus in Jesus, and he begins to sink. Moral of the sermon, keep your focus on Jesus and you won't sink. Sounds right? Okay, but that's not where I ended up going with this. I want to look at this more from the standpoint of Jesus, because I think there's something that if we don't look a little bit deeper, we miss. Immediately, he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. And after he dismissed the crowd, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. So let's start with a little bit of context here. Chapter 14 starts out with the execution of John the Baptist. Okay? Jesus finds out about that execution. He actually leaves everybody to go out into the wilderness to be alone, to deal with his grief and this news. The crowds follow him. He ends up preaching, healing, all of the things that he normally does, leads to feeding the 5,000. Okay, now, it's not surprising that in that story, it leads to feeding the 5,000. A little further in Matthew describes this: the greatest among you shall be your servant. Okay, Jesus puts his grief behind him, serves the people, all right? So now he's fed the 5,000. He sends the disciples ahead, all right? Now, this isn't totally unusual to send them ahead, but make a note here. Who sent who ahead? Jesus says, get in the boat and go across the lake. I'll meet you there. He's going up on the mountain to have his time alone in prayer, meditation, all of those things, okay? Now, who already knows how the story's going to end? God wrote our story long before we were ever born. So when Jesus sends them out, he knows what he's sending them into. When evening came, he was there alone. But the boat by this time was a long way from the land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them. And in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them. Does this story sound kind of familiar? Luke 8, verse 22. One day he got into a boat with his disciples, and he said to them, let's go across to the other side of the lake. So they set out, and as they sailed, he fell asleep. And a windstorm came down on the lake, and they were filled with water and were in danger. Sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? I want to talk about a few things here. Just here, like I said, I want to put this in context. So when evening came, you remember in the story when evening came? Feeds the 5,000. Says, disciples, get in the boat. Dismisses the people. Goes up on the mountain. Then 6 o'clock comes. Evening is 6 o'clock. Okay? So this has already happened. Maybe it took an hour. Maybe, I don't know how long it was, okay? But there's already been a period of time. It's 6 o'clock. He's on the mountain. They're already a ways off. Interesting side note. He comes to them on the fourth watch. Anybody want to take a guess when the fourth watch is? It's the darkest part of night. Fourth watch is between 3 and 6 a.m., remember, we were at 6 p.m. here. Best case scenario is he comes to them at 3 a.m. at the start of the fourth watch. That's 9 hours. 9 hours. The Sea of Galilee, that's what we're crossing. Now, it sounds pretty impressive when we said sea, right? The Sea of Galilee is 8 miles wide and 10 miles long. Unless you're at the grocery store shopping with my wife, the average person walks 3 to 4 miles per hour. Do some of you have wives that walk a little faster than that? She's about 20, I think. But it's 3 to 4 miles per hour. So to be able to walk across the sea should take about 3 hours, right? Is my math right on that? Come on, guys. Wake up. You got to remember, I have some background in elementary education. I need things to be interactive. And considering most of that was recess duty, you really have to... Do we have to play dodgeball? Is that... Okay, practice. Yeah, no. Okay, good. Josie's got it. All right. So 3 hours to make this walk. But didn't we figure we're probably 10 hours into this journey? And it doesn't say that they're almost there. Now, the average speed of a rowboat, and if you look through the 3 out of the 4 Gospels that have this story, they say in there that they were rowing, is about the same speed as walking. So they're 9 or 10 hours into a 3-hour journey. What kind of waves and wind do you have to be against to make a 3-hour journey 9 hours and still not be there? This is pretty big, right? They've got to be exhausted. They've got to be tired. They've got to be frustrated. They've got to be any number of other things, right? Frightened, probably. But what do we see happening at this point? It's every good movie, every good story is the same way. This is when the Savior comes, right? Jesus comes when they are in the struggle. Okay? And that's what he does. He loves and cares about us, so he comes. And in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. But when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified and said, "It is a ghost." And they cried out in fear. Now, we already talked about that. That's probably being tired and exhausted and everything else. Fear is probably a pretty normal thing, right? Also, at that time, we already know from studying the Bible and everything that there was a large belief in demons and multi-gods and stuff like that. And one of the common beliefs at the time was that when the seas were rough, when the waves were large, that was an angered demon or group of demons that were putting their wrath out to the people on the sea. Okay? So from one standpoint, when they cry out in fear that it is a ghost, that kind of makes sense, right? But who are these people? They're the disciples. Isn't it interesting that they automatically go back to some former belief in demons making the sea rough? Especially when you remember Luke, that story we talked about in Luke. And they went and woke him, saying, "Master, Master, we are perishing." And he woke and rebuked the wind and the raging waves, and they ceased. And there was a calm. He said to them, "Where is your faith?" And they were afraid, and they marveled, saying to one another, "Who then is this that he commands even winds and water?" And they obey him. See, they still didn't get who he was. They still didn't understand. It is interesting because they were there when he did the miracles. They were there when he did the healing. They were there when he calmed the sea the first time. But yet they don't remember that when he comes to them the second time. They also don't mention this, and here again, this is probably just my brain being a little bit curious, but they don't mention anything. Jesus just walks there. They see him and he's just walking on water. Okay, I'm not ashamed to say this. Between services, I was out there and I tripped over a flat spot in the carpet. I can't imagine walking on rough water. How many of you guys trip over a wrinkle in the carpet or anything? How many of you trip over nothing? Yep. And Jesus is just taking a stroll across water. No big deal. Just walking. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid." Now, if you are keeping up on Pastor's Ask Anything series, you might know that the one this week that was posted, he talked about different translations of the Bible, and he talked about how accurate some of them are as far as word to word and translating to different languages. And I'm not going to go into a lot of that, but I would highly recommend you watch that. But it was curious that he did that after I had done this sermon. Okay? Because in Matthew, Mark, and John, they all talk about this story. Okay? They all talk about Jesus walking on water. They all talk about the disciples seeing Jesus and crying out in fear. And they all say the same thing. Jesus's reply is, "It is I. Do not fear. Do not be afraid." But he always says, "It is I." Now, if you get into Greek, I'm not going to speak Greek. I do not know hardly anything about Greek. I even tried to do the little Google Translate thing to have it say the word so I could look really cool and say them. We're not doing that. But if you look at the phrase, "It is I," and you look at the words in the original Greek that were spoken, "It is I" is also the exact same words can be translated as "I am." Now, Jesus says "I am" throughout the New Testament. There's all kinds of places where he says "I am." All right, same Greek words when he says "I am" as in this, where it's translated as "it is I." Okay? If you think about that, there's one other place in the Old Testament where God identifies himself as "I am." I am who I am. Okay? I am Yahweh. I am God. I believe what we're seeing here is Jesus is not identifying himself to the disciples as, "It's me, Jesus, your teacher, the guy you were just with today." That's not what he's saying, okay? He's saying, "I am God." That's what he's saying, okay? So let's keep going. Peter answers him saying, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." And Jesus said, "Come." So Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came to Jesus. Okay? Let's go back into our vast knowledge of Greek. In that phrase where Peter says, "Lord, if it is you," I'm not going to say the words in the Greek translation, but based on the tense of the verb that you're saying, there's two translations for "if." With the way this is written, based on the tense of the verb, and don't ask me what all that means, because that part of English has been a long time ago, but based on the tense, it can also mean, instead of "if," it can mean "since." Okay? If it is an indicative tense verb, then it is building a true case. And in this case, what Peter is saying here is, "Since it is you, command me to come out." So understand what this verse is saying. What Peter is saying is, "God, because it is you, command me to come to you." Now, doesn't that just change the whole setup of everything? I mean, let's face it. How many of you have been there where you're like, "Well, God, if this is what you want me to do, let me know." Okay? If this is it, if. But what if you change the narrative and it's "God, since you want me to do this"? See, Peter is not lacking faith in who is commanding him to come out onto the water. He knows who this is. He knows what he can do. "God has commanded me to come out onto the water." That's a completely different thought process here. Why was Peter able to walk on the water? It wasn't because of his faith in Jesus. It was because he was commanded by God to do it. And Jesus was right there. Okay? He was standing right there. Now, he's not standing right there for us, is he? At least I've never had that. I've never had Jesus standing right there commanding me to do something. But let's keep going a little bit. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid and began to sink. He cried out, "Lord, save me." Jesus immediately reached out his hand and took hold of him, saying, "O you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got to the boat, the wind ceased, and those in the boat worshiped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." Peter was all the way to Jesus. He was all the way there. He had already done the walking on water. All right, I don't know about you. If I step out of a boat, I sink. That's it. Right? Just like that. Everybody else with me? There was a point where I thought about bringing some water up here and demonstrating that, but I think you pretty much all get that point, right? Let me read that again, though. He began to sink. Well, that's curious. I didn't know sinking had a beginning, a middle, and an end. I mean, when I go into the water, is anybody else? Do you have a beginning and a middle and an end? No, I just sink. It's like that, just the end. Okay? But in this case, it's specifically written that he began to sink. Part of this story is that it has to happen in a time for Peter to react and Jesus to react. Okay? Now, maybe in reality it was like that, but you understand that for Peter and Jesus, there was plenty of time for him to walk there, see the waves, begin to sink, cry out, and Jesus to take his hand. Okay? That's how close they were together. That's how the process works. And then we have the wind. Let's talk about the wind a little bit. How do you see the wind? It says he saw the wind. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid and began to sink. So he saw the wind. I don't believe that he actually saw the wind. I don't think that the wind and the waves is what made him doubt here. Okay? We've already established that he knew who was calling him out. We already established that he knew that the person that was calling him out had the power to give him the ability to do this. Okay? That's why none of us, there's only one person that I know of that's walked on the water, and that's Peter. And the only reason he was able to do it is because God said, "Do it." And unless God says that to one of us, none of us are going to be able to walk on the water. He didn't see the waves and lose faith in Jesus. I think what he did is he saw the situation and he didn't doubt in the power of God. He doubted in himself. He said, "I'm not good enough to do this." How many of you have been in that situation where you're like, "I'm not good enough to do this"? I was talking to somebody after the last service, and I bet you this morning five or six times before the first service started, I said the same prayer. Two things. God, turn me off and turn you on, and let me be a conduit, a speaker to the message you want to deliver. Okay? This isn't about me. Do I doubt? Yeah, I'm not a scholar. I'm not a theologian. I can't even say the word I'm not. That's not me. I will give you sidebar if any of you do end up preaching. Okay, I don't know how it worked out this way, but I've been lucky enough where the two times I've preached, the passages that I've decided to preach on were things that Stephen's never preached on. So you can get together with him, and as Katie says, he gets all nerdy with his how to break down the passages and everything because he's never done it before. It's actually kind of fun. It probably makes me look a little bit better than I am. But we all have doubts. We all go through that process. We're all fallen. We all have sin. That doesn't change. The doubt in yourself is part of the sin. It's built into you. We can't get away from that. I want to read to you one of the... Andrea is a graduating senior, and one of the last books she had to read for her language arts was The Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis. And if you haven't read that book, I would highly recommend that you do, because you want to talk about a book that's written from the perspective of demons trying to corrupt man and what their agenda and the process they use is. Man, if you want to know how Satan acts in our lives, read that book. From way, way, way back, I think in the late 30s was when it was written, and it is 100% correct. But here's a couple of quotes from there. Gratitude looks to the past, and love looks to the present. Fear, avarice, lust, and temptation look ahead. See, I think that's where Peter was. I think Peter saw the fear, and that's why he started to sink. Because he knew he wasn't good enough to do that. He didn't doubt God. He saw the doubt in himself. Here's another one. There is nothing like suspense and anxiety for barricading a human's mind against the enemy. Remember, these are demons. So when they're talking about the enemy, they're talking about God. Good guy's the bad guy. It's weird. But that's the way it's written. He wants men to be concerned with what they do. Our business is to keep him thinking about what will happen to them. See, that's where Peter was. He started thinking about what's going to happen to me now? What's next? So then they get back into the boat. Jesus grabs him. They get into the boat. And everybody begins to worship him. That sounds pretty much like a New Testament story, right? They see what he does and they worship him for who he is and what he's done. And Jesus says, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" Well, he knew the answer. He doubted because he can't help it. He doubted because we're fallen. He doubted because that's in our nature. We can't separate ourselves from the fact that we're fallen. We just can't do it. So he knew the answer. So we know that we can't live life without doubt because we can't separate ourselves from that. Jesus isn't asking him why did he doubt in himself. What Jesus is asking him, I think, is, why did you doubt in my power? Why did you doubt in what I commanded you to do? See, that's the gist of this. The title of the sermon is Get Out of the Boat. Now, for some of us, maybe he's already commanded us to get out of the boat. Maybe he's commanding you to get out of the boat right now. If he hasn't, he will. There's going to be a point where you're going to have to get out of the boat. And you're going to doubt that you personally have the ability to do what God has put before you. You can't help it. Jesus isn't saying, be better yourself so you can do what I need you to do. That's not it. That's the wrong message. The message is, get out of the boat. I'm commanding you to walk on the water. I'm here with you. I'm commanding you to do this. All you need to do is know that I'm God, and I will make you be able to do that. Don't doubt in God's power. Now, I go back to the question I asked before. In this case, Jesus is standing right there. Jesus said, I am God. Get out of the boat and walk on water. Peter says, I know you're God. Command me to do it. Come on out. We don't have that luxury of Jesus standing there saying that to us. But is Jesus here? Or is Jesus off in heaven somewhere? Or is Jesus tending to someone somewhere else? See, sometimes I think we're tempted to think that God's not with me. But we are in the midst of God's creation. He, a part of him, is in everything around us. And the Holy Spirit is here. It's never not here. God is never not here. The problem that we have as fallen men is what sometimes is lacking is our connection with God. He's always here. He's always ready to grab on when we call out. Always. Never is he not here. Never is he not ready. Never is there not enough time. He's always here for us to call out. Here's the way I think that this works. It starts with your relationship with him. It starts with your relationship with God. Once you have a relationship with God, that leads to knowing who he is. Once you know who he is, then you can know where he is. And once you know where he is, and the converse of that is where he isn't, once you know where he is, that leads to knowing that he's there for the calling and the lifting. The message today is not a message of believing more or overcoming yourself or anything like that. See, the relationship that Jesus is looking for, the relationship that God designed us to be in, is ongoing, okay? It never stops. Once it starts, it's ongoing. Forever. That's the rules. What Matthew's trying to tell us here is it's not a matter of having doubt that God is not there for you. It's the ongoing trying to maintain the connection. That's the challenge. That's the message. That's what I put onto you today, is spend every day for the rest of your life trying to maintain that connection. Is it going to be perfect? Nope. Don't walk out the door thinking that somebody's got it better than you've got. Because it's not. We're all fallen. We all have sin. We're all going to doubt. We're all going to struggle. We're all going to have to call out because we get distracted by the wind. That's the way it's supposed to work. When you find you're in that situation, call out, and he is there to take your hand and to take you back to the boat. That's what the message is. It ends by saying, truly, you are the Son of God. If you go on to read any of the rest of the Bible, you know that that statement, truly you are the Son of God, is not a done deal. So my prayer, and the way I'm going to end this, is to pray that God, you just lift us up, that you show us the connection, that we see the commandment, and that you be with us, and that we struggle every day to maintain that connection with you, and that you reach out and take us by the hand when we need you.